This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So it's my pleasure to introduce Mia Bloom, currently at Georgia State University.
I like the way he says currently, because you never know where I'm going to be next. Where is she now? So, I'm doing something a little bit different because this is a theoretical chapter, and I use this as an excuse to force myself to get back on track with our writing for Small Arms, which is a book John Horgan and I are writing about the ways in which violent extremist organizations are luring children into participation. And so one of the things I wanted to do, and it's almost as if Richard Falk had inspired me before he even said it, is this is inherently comparative. Although this image here at the beginning may lead one to believe that I will only be talking about Islamist organizations. In fact, that is not the case. But because of the funding for my research, I always have to give the usual disclaimer, which is this is only my work. I do not represent the Department of Defense. Any mistakes I make also are not representing the Department of Defense, the Minerva Research Initiative, or the Department of the Navy. And I have to do that every time now, which is funny because I'm not even American. All right. I got no clearance. And all right. So violent extremist organizations, we use the term VEOs because we've moved away. We never wanted to say child terrorists. We actually don't necessarily believe that such a thing can exist because they're children and they can't actually make that choice. So part of what we've been looking at is we've been looking at ways in which children are involved with terrorist organizations, avoiding some of the more inflammatory language, baby bombers and killer kids and some of the other stuff that my friend at Georgetown University likes to use. But so they are increasingly targeting children. There is a cost-benefit analysis at work in the sense that organizations use children for a variety of reasons. It taps an additional percentage of the population. It guarantees that the, and by the way, if anyone wants these slides, I'll make them available. Lisa, no problem. So it also makes the movement and the conflict multi-generational because you're ensuring that the next generation is all ready to go. And in doing so, one of the unintended consequences means that it mitigates the effect of target assassination. What we saw in Pozo and Solo with Jamaat Islamiya was that no sooner had the government agents gotten rid of the jihadi fathers that the sons stepped into their shoes. And so what this means is it's impacting an entire generation. But the other benefit that the terrorist groups find in using children in this manner is that, you know, it has this element of surprise. Nobody is expecting the young, innocent child to be dangerous. Additionally, what we found, and this is just anecdotal, so this would be a separate project and maybe something, you know, Rick might want to help us with, the PTSD levels of soldiers who have had to shoot children who are armed is extremely high. And this comes from work that the Romeo Dallaire Foundation is doing at Dalhousie, where General Dallaire receives letters from ex-military people from Canada, the US, all over the world that talk about the levels of guilt that they feel. And part of the reason, although this I'm not going to be talking about this today, but part of the reason is that there's no standard operating procedure about how do you handle children. So what the individual level commanders do is they basically leave it up to the individual combat soldier. And so as you can imagine, because it's not just a set standard operating procedure, that person feels that they are ultimately responsible for that choice. But I don't want to digress. So, and by the way, we actually finally located this Lego with the little militant Legos. But Cornell doesn't want to give one away with each book. I thought that would be like a great little freebie. You get like a little Lego terrorist. But the Children's Human Rights Project is trying to define a universal definition of childhood. Some of the challenges that we've had in doing this research project is that on the one hand, the random designation of 18 is very much a Western construct and doesn't necessarily resonate in every culture. A lot of cultures will designate the difference between an adult and a child with some physical manifestation, facial hair, body hair, or some kind of tradition that the child goes through, a bar mitzvah, or a period of time where they go off to the desert and then they come back and they're, you know, an adult. So the problem with this notion of 18 is problematic from the get-go. The other thing that we discovered in doing some of the field research in Pakistan, many of these kids themselves don't know exactly how old they are. In other words, we have a very Western experience of, you know, your first birthday and your second birthday, and the parents are, you know, every child, that's the first question, or the second question, what's your name, how old are you? They know how old they are. Many of the children that we've encountered, approximately, they don't know exactly how old they are, but give or take. And I think this is something we need to understand, that it's just very different in different contexts. So one of the things that we wanted to try to do with the project is to have culturally relevant, context-specific understandings of what constitutes childhood, but also to understand how specifically some of the structural conditions affect children. And these were going to be very different from adults. And I'll give you the first example. Work that Alan Krueger has done with Jitka Malakova, back when Richard and I were both at Princeton, showed that there was an inverse relationship between GNP, level of education, and the financial well-being of people who had participated in terrorism. So it wasn't that people who were very poor became terrorists, but actually when he looked at terrorists in a variety of groups, they actually were wealthier and better educated. What we're finding with the children is the exact opposite. We are seeing correlations between poverty and lack of education. So what's interesting is something that has become conventional wisdom for the adults doesn't work with the children. Okay. One of the preliminary assumptions of the project is that in order to understand children's involvement, we really have to understand their initial process of mobilization. So we wanted to chart some of these structural conditions I mentioned, environmental factors. For example, what I'm presenting to you today, the deliberate construction of cultures of martyrdom that are aimed at the youth, but also to understand that as these norms shift, children will value things differently than they would have without this manipulation of the norms. And so, for example, the role of parents, educators, coaches, religious authorities, and state institutions are very important in understanding how you shift the normative environment. Now, one of the things I came across, and I read David Brooks's piece back when he wrote it in 2003, talked about cultures of martyrdom. And I remember thinking, okay, a lot of people use the term culture of martyrdom, but nobody explains what it is. At the Minerva meeting in September, a well-known political scientist from the University of Chicago, who's just received over $1 million to study cultures of martyrdom, the project manager was asked, what is your definition of culture? To which they didn't have a definition of culture. So I think it's important that before we talk about cultures of martyrdom, we have to understand what do we mean by culture. I think it's also important that we emphasize that when we're talking about cultures of martyrdom, and I make this point very clear in the paper version of this chapter, it is not just one culture. So as much as you may hear in the media, on television, and especially this week, jihad, 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 the fact is this notion of a culture of martyrdom exists in every single religious tradition. And if you were to study a culture of martyrdom, the first thing you're going to come across is either a Christian experiences of Polonius going back to Roman times or Samson. You know, so what I wanted to try to convey to you is the diversity of the cultures of martyrdom. Now, the culture of martyrdom is very often embedded with the Durkheimian notion of self-sacrifice and altruism. And we've seen this in Irish republicanism, either for the martyrs from the very old, from the original IRA, or from the hunger strikers from the time of the Troubles. We've also seen this with a culture of Tat Kodai in Sri Lanka, and like you have in Islam and like you have in every other tradition, there is a distinction between self-sacrifice and the word that's used for suicide. Because in all of these traditions, I guess barring the Buddhist, Hindu, accepting those, but of the Abrahamic traditions, the antagonism towards suicide remains very clear. I have in the middle here, though, the well-known, you know, Richard talked about these images that stay with us. We have this well-known image from opposition to the Vietnam War of the Buddhist immolating monks. And I think that the difference between the self-sacrifice and the way in which we've come to understand martyrdom has to do with whether you're the only person who's injured or whether in the process of killing yourself you take a few others with you. And I think that the Gambetta chapter on self-immolation is fantastic and does a better job than what I can do right now. So I would recommend if self-immolation is one of the things you're interested in. Now, the culture of martyrdom that we are most familiar with would be in places like Iran, Pakistan, Palestine, Israel, that are targeting youth in very specific ways. So what we wanted to do in this chapter is break down how do you construct a culture of martyrdom that is targeted to youth. One of the ways we've seen it, and this is again very popular, is Hamas TV for very young, and we're talking children under the age of 12, has used both language and imagery that is going to resonate with very young children, but the message is a very adult message. And so everyone's heard about Farfour, the jihadi Mickey Mouse. At the end of Farfour's run on the television, Israeli soldiers came in and killed Farfour on air, much to the great chagrin of the children. But then I found a cute little duck. I was like, oh, that looks like a Peeps duck. There was a little Easter bunny. So the fact, there's a little Fozzie Bear. So basically, they use imagery that children can identify with, but in order to convey panic or worry, they're not going to talk about nationalistic ideas. In one of these you'll see here, it's like when the Jews destroyed my home and I couldn't find my notebook. I mean, that's the kind of panic a 10-year-old can relate to. Oh, I can't find my notebook and I have a test. That's, they're not gonna be able to panic about the onslaught of Israeli soldiers or the loss of the olive grove. That's going to be above, you know, their bailiwick. But a child can understand the panic of losing your notebook. The other thing that we've seen is the manipulation of children's textbooks. I have an example here from Nazi Germany. We have examples of Mickey Mouse in terms of the way in which they portrayed African Americans in the 1930s and 40s, as well as a child's, this is a snapshot of a child's textbook talking about martyrdom to children. The issue of having it in the environment, you know, Elisa said something about out of place and in place yesterday, about being in environments in which it is all around you, it becomes a normalized discussion. It becomes almost routinized in the daily expression of martyrdom that every time you walk by a wall, there are depictions of martyrs. And what I've done here is I've depicted martyrs, one of them being the very first suicide bomber in Iran, Hossein Fahmideh, very young 15-year-old, who not only, and I couldn't find a picture of this because Bob Baer has it in his documentary, of the lunch boxes with Hossein Fahmideh's image, that kids for a whole generation in Iran took their lunches in a Hossein Fahmideh lunchbox. But as you can see, the idea of these murals, whether it's the Warsaw Ghetto or whether it's Bobby Sands, to convey the sacrifice. And in many ways, in these cultures, the people who are martyrs are their superstars. So streets, posters, graffiti, all featuring martyrs, are everywhere. And the children, you know, I have a still here of the kids just hanging out at the wall. I mean, it's everywhere in, you know, Nablus and Palestine, the West Bank, but not just. It's in places like Pakistan, it's in places like Iran, it's in places in which you are trying to convey to this next generation the benefit of death over the benefit of life. And this is really, it's a sale. Now, I added one thing 2 days ago, but I had this before. The role of women is something that is continues to be very misunderstood. I think even with UN Security Council Resolution 1325, embedded within it is this idea that women automatically have a pacifying effect. And we are still living generations in the past to think that women cannot be violent. Whether it's the research of Derek Cohen at Harvard, who has looked at women in militant movements throughout Africa as killers, as leaders of the death squads, versus women who have participated either directly in terrorist attacks or encouraged their children to participate, the role of mothers becomes crucial. One of the images below here of Reem Riashi, who was an Islamic Jihad bomber in 2004, you know, people were saying this week, how could a woman leave a six-month-old child and go and perpetrate a terrible terrorist attack? And I said, we have this from 10 years ago. We also have the Chechen women. We have a woman like Maryam Farhat, who became a superstar, in fact, was elected on the Hamas ticket, and in part because three of her sons became bombers. So part of it is this notion, and Hamas sort of went to the next level on making a series of commercials depicting Reem Riashi, that ultimately the jihad was more important than her child, and conveying that that is the ultimate. Like Sumaya, at the time of the Prophet, who was, again, the very first martyr in Islam, turned out to be a woman in 615, this idea that there are things that are more important even than motherhood. So the role of mothers becomes crucial, both in terms of exacerbating the situation, normalizing violence, reproducing a culture of violence within the family so that the children are raised with the ideology and the ethos, as well as the fact that we've seen women can be really important in CV, in countering violent extremism. One of the ways in which a friend of mine is the leading Salafi police officer in the UK, and one of the things that he has done when dealing in a hostage crisis with a Muslim who's holding hostages, he calls their mother. The mother, you know, this idea of disappointing your mother is very, very powerful, and it's one of the ways that is very effective to convince someone who is fully committed not to go through with it. But the question then is, so we've got women who are helping and women who are hurting, and how do we make that distinction? So what we did, so Ian and I, Ian Elliott, who is at the University of Birmingham in the UK now, we looked at the literature on grooming by pedophiles, and we only changed two words. The word we changed was, we added the phrase culture of martyrdom, and everything else comes from the literature on pedophilia, David Finkelhorst, Suzanne Ost, and others. The idea is that the children are being groomed online and offline in very, very much the same ways that children are groomed for sexual predation. And some of the same tricks of the trade that the pedophiles use, terrorist recruiters are using. And this has everything to do with which child is selected, because as you know, not every child becomes a bomber. It's one of the ways in which Daesh or ISIS is able to convey to children that you want to be an ISIS cub. They make it a competitive sport that, you know, you have to win that position of being a cub. But as well as the fact that what is the use of deviant peers or intermediaries? We know from the research that the children are rarely recruited by much, much older adults. Instead, there's an intermediary who is either slightly older, but certainly someone to whom they can look up and admire, that is very often the node, the person who's the intervening variable between the recruiter and the target. We've also seen this notion of rapport building. I'll give you an example. Aksa Mahmood, who is the recruiter for Daesh or ISIS from Scotland, she's very often the person who is recruiting women from the UK. Because if you are from the UK and someone is talking to you about PG tips and Jaffa cakes, that's going to resonate. They have a different set of celebrities and different music. And if you're talking to an American about a Jaffa cake, they're going to have no idea what you're talking about. And so the idea is that Hoda Muthani from Alabama is targeting American women, while Aksa Mahmood is targeting women from the UK. The idea is that it's important to build rapport, because it's in that building of rapport that I then think Lars's research kicks in, to alienate the person from the family by creating a substitute and new family. And again, this is precisely what pedophiles do. They convey this notion of isolation from the existing family, keeping secrets, okay, it's just between you and me, don't tell anybody, and then they build upon there. The other thing we've seen is that the process looks very similar in terms of the process of desensitization. John and I finished the chapter on looking at the processes of socialization, which actually included everything from selection to finally having the children involved. So they went from being observers of violence, they had to witness it, to then participating. And this is precisely what pedophiles do with regard to sort of sexual engagement. They don't start right away. Well, you know, Sandusky may be different, but they don't start right away. They don't jump the child. Usually what they do is there's this process of grooming. There's tricks, there's treats. They'll make the child watch pornography before they try to get them to engage in pornographic or sexual behavior. And so the idea is they go from being passive observers to fully committed participants. Now, when we're looking at this, we're looking at societal influences, we're looking at the role of teachers, parents, and coaches, because ultimately the adults in these scenarios, both for the pedophiles as well as for the children being groomed, need to be on board in order to allow the terrorists or the pedophiles access. And you know, for those of you that haven't seen the Spotlight film, I highly recommend it. But the idea that the parents let the priests have access to the children was crucial, because at the end of the day, if the parents don't let anyone near the child is less at risk. I'm going to stop here because I just got a red flash. And thank you again for your time. I know this is very, very new. I'm working on the paper, but the paper is looking at traditions of martyrdom and self-sacrifice in all the religious traditions, and then going to break it down into what are the specific elements, whether it's education, textbooks, the environment, streets, parks, squares. And this is not just focusing on one particular religious tradition, but we're looking at it in all of the traditions. Thanks so much for your time.
Question. Yeah, Mia, you mentioned that not every kid becomes a suicide bomber, of course. Do you have any hunches about which ones do and which ones don't? What would be the decisive issues on that to look at?
So, you know, we were fortunate to be at Penn State affiliated with a fantastic psychology department. Sandy Azar, who works a lot with children who are in the foster care system, had done a study, I think something 1,500 foster care families that had had financial problems, and they had to give a kid back. Which kid did they choose? And so Sandy said, when you're looking at which child is chosen, look for the following criteria: a middle child, or a child that's having behavioral problems, or some other, you know, problem in school, whether it's ADHD or ADD. Now, of course, the middle child thing is problematic right away, because the average family size is 6 to 10. So everything is middle. So the middle didn't necessarily help us. But the fact that, you know, not the oldest who was a breadwinner, not the youngest who's still too young, but amongst those middle children, which one did you choose? Because we are coding for birth order, was children who had had some sort of behavioral problem. Because the kid that's doing well in school, the middle child, the parents like, no, we're not going to give this child. So the stereotypical story that we encountered in Pakistan, in the Swat Valley, was, you know, there's a knock at the door, and it's the Pakistani Taliban demanding 5,000 lek. 5,000 lek would be an annual salary for many of these impoverished families in Fatah and Swat, and so obviously they cannot pay it. So in lieu of payment, the terrorists would demand, okay, well, give us one of those 10 kids. Which of the 10 kids did you give tended to be both middle child, child with behavioral problems, not the child doing well in school. And so the children in the facility at Sabaun, which is a rehabilitation facility in the Swat Valley in Malakand, ranged from 6 years old all the way to 16, and they ended at 16, not because we thought 16 was the age to end it, but above 16, the Army sent them to a different facility for adults, and they were treated as, you know, convicted terrorists. But the idea was that under the age of 16, the Pakistani government felt that maybe these kids could still be saved and salvaged and, you know, have a normal life. And so that's where we were getting some of the data. So the data is consistent that, you know, it's with the pedophiles, it's the kid who's not so popular, who's a bit of a loner. And so it starts looking like some of the characteristics that we've described or you've described as the lone actor shooters. But these are not, it's not going to be the most popular kid. He doesn't need the group for validation. It's going to be the kid who's seeking something greater. Do you have a follow-up, John?
The implication then is that anybody that is given away, or whatever, taxed away, you might say, then becomes a suicide bomber. Is that correct? Or even after that, the question is not only
which one failed
the training, in other words.
So one of the things that, you know, given that we had a population of 289 children at the facility over the last few years, one of the things was the children who were coerced, we were expecting the children who were coerced to be more likely chosen as suicide bombers. We also had a percentage of children who had run away and joined the group voluntarily. So there was actually an inverse relationship between the level of coercion and whether or not that child got the responsibility of being a suicide bomber, because the ways in which many of these kids avoided blowing up is they allowed themselves to be caught because they really didn't want to be there. But the ones who had been fully committed or had been given away by a family member had been convinced that this was a good thing. And so we had variation in the kinds of roles. Most of the children that we encountered weren't successful suicide bombers because they're still alive. But so we have some data, but there does seem to be an inverse relationship. The thing that we found very surprising, and it's very disturbing and upsetting as I share this with you, when a child, when they determined that a child was going to be a suicide bomber, some of the commanders passed the boy around and fiddled with him and took advantage in exactly the same way that the pedophiles do. And so at this point, they just figured there's nowhere for him to go, because they've now done something that is so shameful in the society that, you know, this child isn't going to try to run away. No one will take him. And so we started to see this not just among the Pakistani children, all of whom in our sample were boys. We also started to see this in the Afghan situation of boys who had been bachabazi, the dancing boys of Afghanistan, who are also passed around. If they're not adopted into the family by being married off to the warlord's daughter to keep them close, they were funneled into some of the Pakistani Taliban groups to be bombers for the same reason. There was nowhere to go back from there. So it is a very strange intersection of gender-based sexual violence and motivation for being a terrorist or a suicide bomber, because there isn't really a choice. They're given no choice, because the alternative is a life of shame or to be killed by members of your family for dishonoring the family name. Sorry, I knew it was upsetting. I tried to clean it up a bit.
Okay, I was looking around to see if there was anyone asking a question, but I will. So you began with child soldiers, but actually, I mean, for the most part, you've moved away in terms of what was the second half.
Because of the culture of martyrdom part.
Because of the culture of martyrdom. So we begin with the child soldiers, and so the conundrum you raised in terms at the beginning, for example, about how the military handles confronting child soldiers, there actually doesn't apply to this particular part of the study.
It applies in the sense of American soldiers in Afghanistan who were facing children who were part of the terrorist groups. I'm hesitant to use child terrorists. Found themselves experiencing some of the same psychological breaks as soldiers who faced children who were formerly part of militias. like in Liberia, Sierra Leone, Uganda, and so on. Mm-hmm.
I do know that at the present time, up until last time I checked, that for example, the Marines are very clear in their training.
There is a clear. Okay, what is it now?
They're clear in their training, and it's their unfortunate conclusion at this point. I mean, it is what would be the typical expectation of the Marines protecting Marines and commanders, which is if you're in doubt, they don't want hesitation because hesitation loses the company. So that, I mean, at this point, because they can't tell if they're confronting child soldiers, not suicide bombers, but child soldiers, people formed with AK-47s, it's really hard to overcome. And at this point, the training is to shoot.
Except you saw, I mean, and again, this maybe fictitious depiction of Kyle in American Sniper, where, you know,
I understand.
Basically the command. So what we've been told is that maybe that's recent, that up until now there isn't in the manual an explicit stated, this, you know, if you see X, then Y. You know, we had instances from the soldiers who came back that said, you know, we came across there was a car or a taxi careening towards a checkpoint. And, you know, the Americans are gesticulating for them to stop. And the taxi driver continues, and so they start shooting. And it turned out that they just didn't understand what was going on, and they killed two kids in the back seat. And then there was, you know, you had to answer for why that occurred. So what happened was, the next time they saw kids, even though these kids were burying IEDs on the road, they didn't take them out. They basically said, okay, shoo, go away. So the problem is that it was, in many ways, maybe that's changed, and then I'm glad for the correction, it was very much on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah, you can be sure that that many of the soldiers will need psychological assistance afterward. I mean, there's no question about that, but that's a different issue.
I'll get the new Marine Corps.
But the other thing, I think it's important in terms of, I was trying to follow some in terms of, you've got the force recruitment and the what's called television socialization that you showed. But the television socialization you showed, of course, was not in the particular case of the kids that you're studying.
Oh yes, we're looking at Palestinians.
Okay, well, you said Pakistanis.
The Pakistanis, we actually have interview opportunities.
Okay.
But the idea is to compare across not just Islamic groups, but Islamic, non-Islamic. So we're looking at Ughra Sinn Féin, for example, which is in Northern Ireland.
Okay. So we have, in either case, you have this coerced group.
Yeah.
Right? And we have large numbers. We know that there are large numbers of coerced child soldiers in various African contexts, as Lost Boys of Sudan. You know, we have a long history of that, etc. And the question, I see you make mention that you're looking at the difference between their being chosen for suicide bombing, but there is obviously, what about all these other possibilities in terms of fighting? I mean, what's the distinctions there?
Okay, so there's a variety of roles, and one of the things that we discovered is, like with the adults, you know, it's not just one role. You can hold multiple roles simultaneously. Most of the kids from the Pakistani group, when they were arrested, when you ask them what do they do, oh, we were just porters and cooks and we cleaned things up. But inevitably, that's sort of how you start. Eventually, you're given more and more responsibility, and you're told to do things that are more and more horrible. Which inevitably means that the children are traumatized. So even like the worst cases where children have engaged in ultimate violence, they're still in many ways victimized themselves because they've been exposed to the trauma. One of the things that we're seeing, and this is something that's just coming, so this is one of the new findings, and I have to double check it. Rick's helping me out. He's recommended Firke and some other books. One of the things that I'm seeing is that as there is a culture of martyrdom that embeds itself and becomes, you know, routinized on a day-to-day basis, the processes that they used to do in order to prepare someone to be a bomber are no longer needed. So when I wrote Dying to Kill 12 years ago, And you would prepare a suicide bomber. You would bury him alive in a grave, you know, not cover him up with dirt, but you would put him in the grave to show that, you know, death will not kill you. And you would convince them that the martyrdom will be like just a tiny pinprick, and that it'll be in a second you'll be in, you know, heaven by Allah's side with your huris and everything else. They no longer need to convince people to do it because the kids are sort of pre-convinced. Because this idea of martyrdom is something that people aspire to. Now, what we have between the difference of coercion versus children who are aspiring towards it, there's an element of voluntariness that we've been trying to wrap our brains around, because we start with this notion that they're under 18, they're kids, they can't make these choices, but yet we are seeing that there is something at least looking like voluntariness, that the children are, or the parents at least are complicit, and the children are enthusiastic versus coerced. And so we're laying out, so what we've done is we've taken all the biographies and autobiographies of child soldiers, and we've coded them for 118 different elements to try to get a baseline. So looking at child soldiers, and then to see in what ways are children's involvement in terrorist groups similar and different. And the differences had to do with things like education and the role of parents and community. So for example, if you're trying to create a next generation, you educate them, you give them the ideology. If you're just using children as cannon fodder, you don't waste your resources educating children in Uganda and Sierra Leone or the Lost Boys of Sudan. So here are different elements that we can show that it's not just as someone under 18 holding a gun. So the work is in some ways not overtly a critique of Peter Singer, but trying to take to task that we can't just lump together all these groups because they happen to employ people under the age of 18. Victor?
So Mia, just I've got this clear. Your data collection is focusing on Pakistan and Palestine?
And Daesh.
And Daesh, okay.
But, you know, in terms of the interviewing.
Right.
Stodgy.
So I think the findings are very interesting. It occurs to me that it might be useful in the future to also try and do research in Africa, because I think that
I just said about the we've covered
right.
All
right. No, I understand that, but in terms of getting at this more empirically, you've got a situation where I think the child soldier phenomena, as you're pointing out, is very different in a lot of these countries in Africa than it is in some of these countries in the Middle East.
One of the reasons we wanted to look at this in a global way, and the reason I presented the cultures of martyrdom across European, global South, was to convey that this is not something that is associated with a region of the world, and it's not something, you know, for lack of a better way of phrasing it, that those people do, but we don't. So, you know, in as we were coding biographies and autobiographies, we discovered two things that really did challenge a conventional wisdom. First, conventional wisdom, and you'll get this in whether it's the children's reports from UNICEF or Peter Singer, that you see a proliferation of child soldiers as guns got smaller. So this idea of the introduction of the AK-47 or some smaller weapons that small hands could manipulate this. Except for the fact that with the Buffalo Soldiers, both the War of Independence, the war against the British, the Civil War, we found lots of children. Now, of course, the guns are about the same size as the kid, but it didn't inhibit participation of children. And so that was one of the first things that we noticed. It wasn't about that. The other thing that we noticed is the United States used lots of child soldiers, and not just as drummer boys. And so this is something that, you know, when we're looking at those cultures that exploit children in these ways, we have to also include Northern Ireland and Britain and the United States, because in looking at this in a longer period of time, we're capturing democracies that have used children and not just authoritarian regimes and horrible dictators.
And that's why I think the culture of martyrdom works for some of these conditions, but I think for a lot of the child soldiers in Africa, for example, or if you're talking about historical cases like the child soldiers in the U.S. or the ones who served in the U.K. and so forth, I don't think they were serving there for culture of martyrdom. I mean, I think for a lot of the kids in Africa, they're serving there in a cultural life. I mean, I don't mean that cultural life. They're serving there because that's the way to stay alive.
Well, yeah, so it's protection, and it's
right.
So the stereotypical story we have from Africa, the parents are not present. They're not alive. It's not like they are allowing the group to access their children. Usually the parents are killed, and in fact, sometimes it's the child who has to be the person who killed them.
And that's why I'm saying framing the culture of martyrdom across the board.
Well, I didn't have African examples because I wasn't saying that this, in Africa it doesn't work. There's no level of voluntariness whatsoever. In Africa, it's pure coercion. And what we were trying to convey is that if there was any level of voluntariness, it had to do with changing the normative calculations of the parents and of the children, that this is something that someone aspired to versus someone was forced into it.
Well, take advantage, and we'll stop right there. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
All right, it's we're in, certainly we have three more presentations. We're lucky, they've all been good. And I expect the, that was not even implied. I'm going with the statistical probability that we will all be good. And so it's my great pleasure to introduce Laura Dugan from the University of Maryland, and I should mention that we had also invited Erica, but she was unable to come. So Laura is presenting the paper on that they're both the halves.
Thank you, everyone. So I've been hinting, I feel like, I almost said I've been hinting all week about what I've been talking about, but it's only been 2 days. So I'm gonna be talking today really about rethinking counterterrorism. We've talked a lot about constructing terrorism, but and a lot of what we've discussed in the past couple days have been about how do we address terrorism in ways that are different from how we typically do it. And so let me start by talking about rethinking counterterrorism. And I just pulled some quotes from famous American presidents that show general attitudes toward terrorism. So you can see the first one is from Reagan, "Let terrorists beware," that when rules of international behavior are violated, our policy will be one of swift and effective retribution. And that's something that certainly has played out since that quote in 1981, I believe it was. And then you can see George Bush used some famous lines, "Wanted dead or alive, smoke them out, bring them on." And then, of course, most recently, everybody has made reference, or not everybody, but we've heard the references to the French president talking about how France is at war after the attacks in Paris. From a criminological perspective, but I'm sure from all of your perspectives as well, this is very much about deterrence, right? We show them that you will be punished if you continue to do these things, or if you do these things, you will suffer, basically. So those are the general attitudes. Now, with those statements, in the paper that I gave, I talk about the long history of how that's been an important idea, at least in the U.S. criminal justice system, but in a lot of the justice systems across the globe, this idea of deterrence. What do we really know about the effects of deterrence on terrorism? I'll show you some findings that we've done. This is a study that we did actually not like 10 years ago, but this is just looking at aerial hijackings, and these are, you know, three big interventions in the early 70s, and we analyzed the effects of these interventions on different types of hijackings. The bars below one means that they have an effect on reducing the risk of hijackings, but what I want to point out is that when we looked at just terrorist hijackings, we had no effect, and so that suggests that terrorists are a little bit different from regular hijackers. This is a paper we did a little later in Northern Ireland looking at some main interventions by the British government on Republican terrorism. Looking at the same types of bar charts, what you could see is that there seemed to be some possible deterrent effect with Operation Motorman, which is a big surge of military in the area. However, what we found is that with three of the interventions, we had some evidence of backlash. And so so this idea of backlash isn't surprising given the discussion that we've had yesterday and earlier today about what, you know, when governments act repressively, there could be some pushback with this. Some other results relevant to deterrence. So here's some possible substitution effects with metal detectors. Here, this isn't surprising. When we bombed Afghanistan, then we actually increased the popularity of bin Laden. The bombings in Lebanon by Israel increased support for Hezbollah. And so what we see, here's some evidence where there's possible deterrence with anti-environmental terrorism, and then we found nothing with abortion, or not we, but Pride Moore and Freilich. And so basically these findings are mixed. Now I can go into a whole discussion about this, but what I want to point out in the focus of the data set that I'm going to be talking about is that all these studies look at big, obvious interventions. And we know that there's more going on a day-to-day basis with government actions than big, obvious interventions. And so what I want to do is raise the question that perhaps some of the more subtler actions that governments do could have an effect on terrorist activity beyond just punishing wrongdoers. And so this was one of the motivations for developing the Government Actions in Terror Environments data set. This is a project that I've been working on for a long time. I think the original discussion was sometime around 2008 with Erica Chenoweth when she was a postdoctoral fellow at the START Center. And our goal was to collect data on what governments do. We wanted to be able to capture things that weren't just repressive, but also conciliatory. And before we even collected any data, we sat down and we discussed what we wanted it to look like. And so this particular big blank rectangle is where we started. And we wanted to capture a continuum from fully repressive to fully conciliatory. So with death to amnesty. And we wanted to also pay attention to who was affected by the government action. Was it discriminate? Did it only affect the terrorists or the terrorist suspects, or were innocent people or the constituencies affected by it? We also wanted to pay attention as to whether the action was material. So we wanted to capture both material action and non-material action. We wanted actions by multiple actors, so including the judiciary. We wanted actions by police, politicians, and military. And so this is basically what we started off with. And I'm really pleased that I keep presenting the same graph, because we were able to pretty much stick to this model. And so this gives you kind of a sketch of our goal, but also what I feel like we've pretty much achieved. So I'm going to look a little bit closer at this scale from repressive to conciliatory, or from conciliatory to repressive. It's a 7-point scale, and this chart right here in red shows you how we defined the scale measures. So at the top left it says accommodation, full concessions. The in black what you see are examples that are drawn from our Gate Israel data set of actions that fell within to these categories. So accommodation, full concessions was coded as a 1, whereas on the bottom right extreme repression and it says deaths, because we coded as a 7 anything that could lead to deaths. It didn't necessarily lead to deaths, but it could. So raiding of towns and so on and so forth. And so you can see we went from full accommodations. We had material actions that are conciliatory, like lifting a curfew, releasing prisoners, conciliatory statements like praising Palestinians, agreeing to hold talks, expressing optimism about relations. We had some neutral codes for things that were like infighting about Palestinians, and in this case it's Palestinians, failing to reach an agreement, investigating an attack, which is a fairly neutral action. To then on the more repressive side is verbal conflict. So we, again, as the closer you are to the middle, it's more about non-material things, blaming for an attack, denying responsibility for some actions that somebody on their side had done. Physical conflict, again, this physical conflict means not with no... no real threat of fatalities there, so sealing off, imposing a curfew, arresting, and so forth, and then extreme repression. So this is what we came up with, and what I want to point out is that some of these actions affect only the terrorists, but others affect a broader constituency. This is something actually inspired by the work of Clark McCauley. Actually, a number of these things were inspired by his work, but I did a project with him where we really, really stuck to me how important the constituency may be in terms of the activities of the terrorist organizations. And so I'm going to... look at this a little bit closer. Coming from a criminological perspective, criminologists talk a lot about deterrence. There's a lot of literature out there about deterrence, and criminologists talk about specific deterrence, which is about punishing the offender, and the idea is that if you punish the offender in a way, then the offender won't want to do it again. And you know, there's evidence that might or might not work. But then there's general deterrence, which is when you see somebody else being punished, you don't want to do it. So you want to have a broader effect than just on that. And so we have that listed there under punishment of deterrence for repressive actions. But what we want to do is also look at the conciliation. And with that, we also have discriminate conciliation, which is basically directed toward the guilty, it's basically being, I call it being nice to terrorists. and the idea here is that this is an act that really only affects those who are terrorists. So it could be like releasing prisoners and such. But then there's general, which is basically conciliation that's directed toward the constituency in general. In the case of Israel, it's the Palestinians. And so really what we wanted to do is make sure we captured who's being affected by these actions. So how do we collect the data? This is a very arduous process, but it also works. We start, of course, with whichever countries we're studying. We read up as much as we possibly can about it, just so that we have an idea of what to expect. And then we use a program that's been developed by Phil Schroed called Tabari, which is textual analysis augmented by replacement instruction. So we basically use a computer program to help us with this. We download a lot of news stories, mostly from Reuters news articles. That's what we use for most of the gate countries. And then we filter, we download those, run the program. What the program does is it first extracts the lead sentence. So this is all based on the very first sentence. And then what it does is it extracts the politically relevant stories based on many, like thousands and thousands of codes from dictionaries that are of politically relevant actions, actors, and so forth. It codes those, and then what we do is we take those and we filter through based on the coding who the relevant actors are and so on and so forth. And then we human code these. So it's a little bit arduous, but I'm going to show you with pictures what it looks like, just because with this particular group I would think you might be interested. These are what the lead sentences look like. This is for Sri Lanka, which is one of the countries that we're looking at. So we take, this is from Reuters news articles, and you can see some of these are relevant, some of these aren't relevant. From there, we run Tabari. Tabari runs a code. This is what the Tabari codes look like. And if you notice on the very end, we actually keep the lead sentences with it so that we can use those from there on. And so you could see that a number, LKA is the cameo codes for Sri Lanka. And so you can see we're interested in cases like this where we have Sri Lankan government, it's a Sri Lankan actor, and the target of the action is the separatists, rebels. So those are probably the Tamils. Once we use those codes to filter the cases that are meet our criteria, we know that we're going to have some problems in terms of whether they really do meet our cases, do they meet our criteria. The other thing is we take the actions and we pre-code them according to the conciliatory repressive scale, whether they're material, non-material, and discriminate. And we move it into a spreadsheet, and we train our coders to actually go through and read these cases. And then we review the cases, and we have a final clean data set. And this is a snippet of what Gate Israel looks like. A snippet doesn't have all the variables, but you can see the actions, you can see the codes, the conciliatory repressive scale, and so on and so forth. So that's kind of the mechanics of it, but let me show you what it leads to. Well, first, here's an example of one of the lead sentences from 1987. West Bank Palestinian leader Faisal Husseini was released today after 3 months in Israeli jails and vowed to fight against Israel's occupation of Arab areas held since the 1967 Middle East War. This was coded as discriminant material conciliation action, so that's a two, by a judiciary. This is our first grant that we had on this. We collected data from 1988, actually June 1987 through 2004. These are the number of actions we had for each of the countries. You can see that for Israel during that period, we've collected over 6,000 events. So it's definitely a lot more than the six that we had for our Northern Ireland study. Even the one that had the lowest number of cases is still pretty high with Lebanon, that's 307. So that just gives you a sense of what it looks like. Just so you know where we've gone since then, we are collecting data and are in various stages of collecting the data and cleaning for these countries. Canada is done. As I think I mentioned in one of my remarks yesterday, we have most of the Clinton years done for the United States, which is really interesting, actually. I'm going to show you just a few graphs of what the original Middle Eastern countries look like and then talk about what kind of results we can generate from this. It's event data, so we've not done a lot of what can be done with it. This just shows you what the targets look like, and they're not really properly color-coded, but what I want to point out is that for Israel, the majority of the targets for the Gate Israel data are actually Palestinian civilians, whereas in most of the other countries, they're terrorists. So in Egypt, it's Islamic terrorists, and in Algeria, which I don't have my glasses on, but those are also terrorists. The only real exception with that is Lebanon. Now, I can say that Lebanon's a little bit of an outlier in these cases. If you think about it, the criteria for Gate data is that the action has to be by the government, and the target is either the terrorist organization or its constituency. And in Lebanon, the government wasn't very active. And so we didn't include Hezbollah as part of that. So Hezbollah was on the other side of it. And so you'll see in a second what a mess that is. The next slide I'm going to show you is probably one of the ones that I think is most exciting. And that is looking at what our conciliatory and repressive actions look like mapped onto terrorist attacks in those countries. The red bars show repressive actions, the blue bars show conciliatory actions, and the line are terrorist attacks from the GTD data. The only filter on these cases are the country in which the attack occurred, so it's very broadly defined. You can see with Israel that it maps pretty closely. And what's exciting about this is that again, these are two very different ways of collecting data, and the fact that they move similarly is somewhat validating. Egypt, we find the same thing. The scales are different. The terrorism is measured on the right scale. The government actions on the left. Algeria, you know, we see the rise around the same time. The drop isn't quite the same, but it's still pretty interesting. Turkey, I find, is intriguing because we have this rise in terror followed by a rise in repression, and then the terror drops, but the repression just keeps on going. and then Lebanon is a mess. It doesn't really look like there's any relationship between the terrorism and the government actions. We actually want to, we have all the original data, so we actually are talking about going back and looking at international government actions and not just Lebanon government actions to take a closer look at those data. So that kind of gives you a snapshot of what it looks like, and what I'm gonna do now is I'm gonna show you just some of the findings. So this is actually findings from a published paper it was a paper we published in 2012 that looks at Israel and Palestinian actions by the Israeli government, or actions that affect Israelis, Palestinians, and then also attacks against Palestinians. What you see here is, I'm not sure what that bar is, but what we did is we used generalized additive models that really just show the relationship, the non-parametric relationship between the two things, but we controlled for past terrorist attacks, and we looked at monthly, basically we looked at monthly attacks, so we looked at attacks during this month, and we looked at the effects of government actions on last month's, and then we controlled for previous terrorist attacks for last month's and the three prior months to that to try to isolate that effect. This is actually looking only during the second intifada. In the paper, we did it for the first intifada, the Oslo lull period, and the second intifada. I think these findings are most compelling because it really shows this that conciliatory indiscriminate was most strongly related to decreases in terrorist attacks, whereas repressive indiscriminate was related to positive associations. The overall findings for that was when repression had an effect, it was positive, and when conciliation had an effect, it was negative. But the effect was especially strong when it was indiscriminate, when innocent people were affected by it. So we then looked at it, looking at other countries in the Middle East, and we found similar. This is just preliminary, so I haven't really tore this apart to see how robust the findings are, but we found discriminate repressive actions were positively associated, and then we also found indiscriminate repressive actions. Conciliation, we replicated the Israel finding because I used a different method here, but you know, we haven't had as much with conciliation, but certainly we have the backlash with repression. Here's something interesting. This is the Canadian analysis. So these are the same types of generalized additive models. We looked at indiscriminate repression toward Muslims on Al-Qaeda-inspired violence. The Canadian government wanted us to call it that. It was Muslim extremist violence. And so you can see that there's that backlash again. Then we looked at repressive actions in Afghanistan on non-Al-Qaeda related violence, so non-Muslim extremist violence in Canada, and we found that sort of positive effect as well, which was interesting. Also we found in Canada, conciliatory actions in Afghanistan on non-Al-Qaeda, so conciliation had this sort of positive minus, what this means, if you think about it, this is all monthly actions. So if you had a few actions in a month, there was a positive association with non-Al-Qaeda related violence, which is non-Muslim violence. However, you do enough of these conciliatory actions in Afghanistan, then there was a decrease in terrorism. Or actually in Canada, to be fair, I should not use the word terrorism so loosely, there was not a lot of terrorism in Canada. We looked at extremist violence. So they have an extremist violence data set that we used. And then here we have some evidence of, on the right, some evidence of deterrence possibly working with leftist extremism in Canada. So this is discriminate repression. That means punishing the people that are doing things, that are breaking the law, is associated with decreases in that kind of extremist behavior. And then finally, this is from those Clinton years that are almost completed. What we found is actually evidence of deterrence possibly working, with right-wing extremism and on the right. So we have repressive discriminant seems to work. Interestingly, this finding on the right is somewhat surprising. This is conciliatory and discriminant. So this is basically how this is measured. And if had I had the whole 45 minutes to talk, which I originally thought I had, I would have gotten to the guts of this. We coded anything that would really cause either right-wing extremist, or actually the constituency of right-wing extremists to be happy or sad. And so we included a lot of policy actions that go on in the federal government. And so this is when the government was doing things that the right wing would support, right? So this is things during the Clinton administration that were more policy oriented. And so when they were doing things that the right wing would like having stricter, bigger restrictions on abortion, it was related to actually increases. Now and this is pretty persistent. We actually measured this in several ways. We looked at just GTD, terrorist attacks. We looked at, we got hold of a right-wing extremist homicide database, and that held. And then we also looked at right-wing hate crimes. And so anyway, we look forward to disentangle that, especially when, as we start cleaning the bush years, to see if we suspect that that this might have be a function of having a Democratic president. And so we'll see when we do that with the Bush in the Obama years. Anyway, so in conclusions, I just want to reemphasize that the cumulative amount of more subtle actions seem to be relevant to terrorism behavior. Deterrence might work for some groups, like right-wing extremists in the U.S., leftists in Canada, possibly, but it doesn't work for everyone. And it certainly can't. I agree with everything that's been said, yesterday and earlier today about really deterrence is not a there should not be a one-size-fits-all response to terrorism, particularly when it comes to repression. Unexpected backlash is revealed empirically, so it's actually nice to see. What people have been saying all along to show that constituency does matter. It's something that should be paid attention to, and context matters because the results do change depending on the context, and that again goes against the one size fits all. And then because of the name of the conference here, I want to say how we construct counterterrorism matters. So thank you.
I was wondering, could you overlay governmental administration popularity with this and kind of see if there's any interaction?
Overlay what?
Governmental or administration, how the populace looks at it, the popularity of those.
Right. So getting approval ratings?
Yeah.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
We've collected the data for a lot of countries. You guys are seeing really, I just analyzed the U.S. stuff. I was scrambling to get like the entire Clinton administration, but I had to stop at like September of 1997. But that's a good idea to get. So our idea is that we're collecting these. We have these data, but we can obviously incorporate other data. And approval ratings would be something that would be pretty cool. Yes.
I also have a backbench question here. In terms of the sample sizes, the samples that you used. There's two of them that kind of, in my mind, stand out. One is Chechnya, where there is an effective solution. The other is Northern Ireland, where there also is an effective solution. And I was wondering if you had data on these two areas in regards to the actions that were taken.
No, in Chechnya, that's a great idea. We actually have UK
data downloaded, and I think our coders have gone through it, but we haven't cleaned it. So I'm going on sabbatical next spring, and a lot of this is really, I hope to come out with a lot of data and a lot of new articles written. but the actual cleaning of the data has to be done by either Erica or I, so to make sure it's consistent.
Would you talk a little bit more? You're using appeasement as a form of deterrence, right? You're raising the value of the, or am I wrong in that? If you give them what you want, that's a way of deterring them, making them happier, so therefore they're less likely to do bad things. Is that right?
Right. So this is a disciplinary thing. So I've come across this when I've stepped outside of criminology before. So I'm actually using a more traditional form of, when I say deterrence, I'm actually only talking about the effects of punishment or repression. But I know other disciplines look at other ways of stopping as deterring. So what I say is I call that, again, it's semantics, more about offering reward. So rewarding abstaining from terrorism, right? And so it's...
One of your things is withdrawing from villages or something like
right,
that.
Right. And so, yeah, that's conciliation, so that's or not, appeasement.
That's
or,
not a reward. That's basically appeasing them and therefore right. hoping that they will be happy.
Right.
Right. So it's a form of deterrence. It decreases the likelihood that they'll do violence.
Again, semantics. Yes, but if you read the paper that was published in, we don't call it that.
You don't call it appeasement?
No, we don't call it deterrence. So in criminology, again, let me just step back and say one of the things that is really important about studying a problem like terrorism is to bring in all these different disciplines to come and talk about it, but we all use different languages. And so in criminology, we only use deterrence to talk about punishment. And so by you saying appeasement is a form of deterrence, I'm sure you're right, but that's not how I use it, which is absolutely fine, because you have important things to contribute to ours and so on and so forth. But I got in trouble with a bunch of military people when I said that that's not...
Well, they may be wrong. They're looking at it only halfway.
It's semantics.
I mean, if a criminal comes out of prison, you give them $20 million and say, spend it, but you can't commit any more crimes, that would be a form of deterring, right? He would be deterred from, presumably, be turned from going back, assuming he cares
again,
about money.
Again, not according to criminologists.
Unless he enjoys...
I don't want to be on film saying that's deterrence because I'll, get kicked out of my discipline.
you want me kicked out of my discipline? No, that's a sensible way of looking at it. You deter people by giving them what they want.
If you stop them from committing more crimes,
that's deterrence.
By giving them what you want, that's a good thing.
But sometimes it's called positive deterrence, right?
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, there is a literature on that. So.
Small.
I'm sure there is, and again, it's important. I'll put a footnote somewhere. I mean, that's already published, but that other disciplines call that deterrence. The name of the paper that was published is Beyond Deterrence. So it's going beyond just this criminological perspective of deterrence is about punishment. It's about assuring it's increasing the probability of actually being punished, and then it's about the severity and the celerity of punishment. So it's a real punishment-based theory in criminology, not about appeasement at all. But I hear you, and you're right. We're saying the same thing, but using different words.
So the graphs we were saying, those were lag correlations, were they?
They're generalized additive models. So
okay.
they're non-parametric models that, and I actually also ran negative binomial regressions using the same models.
Uh-huh.
So and those were statistically significant in the negative binomials, but the graphs are much cooler.
Yeah.
just because they kind of show the nonlinearity,
right.
Which is interesting.
Have you thought about anything like grandeur causality?
I mean, I've played around with different methods, and this is the one that seemed to be most interesting. I mean, not because it gave me the results I wanted, but it more about I was able to really map what it looked like non-parametrically with what it looked like parametrically. I honestly wanted to start off doing something more like vector autoregressionist.
Mm.
That's not a verb, but or adjective, but. Looking at the mutual relationships, but there were just some modeling limitations with using the government actions as a dependent variable that I want. But
okay.
I haven't given up on that quite yet.
Good.
Yeah.
So if I may, three quick comments. One is I really like what you're doing here, so I want to start with that.
Okay.
The first thought was that the first three examples you gave in terms of to introduce the project in terms of the comments from Reagan, Bush, and Hollande seemed to me to be outside of criminology, retribution, not punishment or deterrence. I mean, they're purely retributive in terms of the way that they're structured. And it leads into the question of the difference between the kinds of things that law is designed to do, which is to deter and to punish, versus simply to destroy, and so that choice, I mean, probably leads to the kind of decisions they make in terms of responding.
Right.
The second, and as an example of this, is the Reagan decision to bomb Libya after La Belle Disco. If you look at the data, which I did way back, there are more incidents claimed by the Libyans as they're being responsible for after the bombing than there are before, and the ones after are far worse than the ones before. I'm sorry?
Including Lockerbie.
Including Lockerbie, yeah. And then the third one, which I was intrigued by the graph of Turkey, which you said, might be really interesting to look through. There's an old study that was done by Steve Wright back, I think, in the 19...
think it's, I can't remember the exact date, but I have it still, in the 1970s on British policy, British military policy in Northern Ireland. And he was able to get this amazing data set, which the Army actually gave him. He then got arrested for having it, but that was a different story. That's just a side thing. But but what it had was all the, each time the military introduced, the data was each time they introduced a new mechanism, so rubber bullets. It's, you know, and it showed IRA at the, what he, the data he has and the analysis he has is a time series on the IRA attacks and incidents, and then British reaction. And so you get the normal flow that you would expect for IRA attacks, which is basically up and down, up and down, up and down. But the British response is, and this is the bureaucratic part, which I think, you know, is interesting in terms of mapping on Turkey, is that if you introduce rubber bullets, they use every bullet they are given every month straight across. And then when they get the new mechanism to try to, the new response, they use everything they have and expend all the armament right through. And so it's a question of they're steady because they have the material and they're going to use what they have. Whether there's an attack or not, because they're there to end the terrorism, right. And it's not responsive to individual events.
Right. That's interesting. So. Yeah, could you send me that paper? Or?
So I'm interested in how you're constructing counterterrorism in this project, right? Because when you first introduced it, I thought it was going to be a database of, right, what you might call counterterrorism policy. But it sounds like you're sort of interested in something much wider, right? And so, you know, am I right in thinking that what you are including is it's sort of like every government action that might conceivably yeah. affect terrorism, or is it things that the government is thinking might affect terrorism, or how do you decide?
Yeah, I'm missing a slide
not.
Clearly because that's a very important point, and I just talked right past yeah. that. So thank you for asking. How it's operationalized? Basically, how we did this is we took every action in which the government was the actor, and the target was either a terrorist, and we identified through our. All the terrorist threats in the particular countries, either a terrorist organization or a constituency to that terrorist organization, and then we kept every single action.
Uh-huh.
So we're not calling it counterterrorism.
Uh-huh. Okay.
We're not calling it counterterrorism at all, although I say at the end we yeah. you know, about rethinking that. The idea is that all actions may or may not matter, and it's an empirical question as to what matters. And so an example that we like to give is that we have in the data the Israelis putting electrical services in the Palestinian refugee camps. That's in there.
So
it's
in
not counterterrorism.
Right, Israel, the
but it's relevant because it's an interaction between the two.
All Palestinians.
Right, and so for different countries, and this is why reading up on all the countries was super important, for every country, different. They all look very different. So the U.S. and Canada and the United Kingdom, which we've not looked closely at the United Kingdom yet, those are really very different because there's not one explicit terrorist constituency, and they're not really identifiable by the codes that we use.
Right, that was my question. I was going to say, in the case of the U.S., right, sort of, okay, maybe
I'll
you can figure
you
out who the groups are, but who are the constituencies of terrorist groups in the U.S.?
So the constituencies that we used, I'm going to show you this
yeah.
just to show you, wait, oh. Actually, okay. Don't look at that yet. I mean, because you don't know what it means. You can look at it, but you won't know what it means. So listen to what I'm saying. So basically, the main threats that we looked at, starting from 1987, and we're going up to 2012, I think, are right-wing extremists, Muslim extremists, jihadi. And we also look at, these are attacks in the U.S. or attacks against U.S. overseas. So anything relevant to groups there on both sides. We look at general counterterrorism, so involvement, U.S. involvement in other people's terrorism conflicts. So like our involvement with Northern Ireland, we keep that as a general counterterrorism thing. Anti-abortion and then environmental. And so those are the main ones. We haven't had any show up in the data other than those. And so we code those explicitly. We code the actions as to whether they are relevant to U.S. soil or they're only relevant overseas. And then we code where overseas they're relevant. So it's a very different structure for that. Because of that, when we did the other countries in the Middle East, the codes that we that we got from running the program were pretty straightforward because of the ethnic and religious identity of the constituencies. So it made it a lot easier. We didn't have that in the U.S. So this is the grant. Actually, they stopped funding us last summer, and we're not even nearly complete. And I'm basically operating on my own dime with this. I'm paying my grad assistant, out of my departmental funds, and then in the summer out of my own pocket. But it's important because it's important data, so we keep it going. The reason it's so hard is that in Israel, so Gate Israel, we originally downloaded about 260,000. Reuters news stories. For the U.S., we downloaded nearly 2 million. We had an issue with search terms, so that was hard. Canada, we had 14 million because we decided to expand. We didn't really decide, but we had to expand beyond just Reuters and use LexisNexis. We ended up with 56,000 to hand code. To make it a little easier, we divided it by administration. So these are how the ones to hand code are divided by administration, where, like I said, what we did is I had the RAs go through them just to remove the irrelevant ones and kept anything that was possibly relevant. That left 7,790 to code. As of now, we actually have the exact same number as the total Israeli cases, 6,063. That's not the entire Clinton years. That goes up to, I think it's September 1997, so I have a few more months left. So it's a lot of work, but it's really kind of important. I mean, it's like become my reason for living. Well, it's not my only reason, but it's... I become kind of obsessed. It's really exciting work because it's allowing part of a story that we need to tell that isn't available any other way. As Rick was saying, or Clark was saying yesterday, the government's not going to release this information. The government doesn't even have this information. But when we're looking at constituencies, a lot of it in the U.S. is about what was going on in Congress. Now, we had to make some choices because we're not keeping all, because you know how, especially during the Clinton administration, but we've seen it throughout, the rhetoric used when they're trying to push policies through Congress, they go on these outrageous campaigns. We actually only captured when the policy is introduced, when it's voted upon, and in various committee things. So we don't keep all of the rhetoric, and we still have quite a few. But we have we have code the traditional counterterrorism, so the bombings that occurred in Sudan and in Afghanistan, and the reactions to Oklahoma City, and all of that kind of stuff is all in there. I could show you. This is the stuff that. Wait, this is all of it. So this is basically just looking at right-wing stuff and right-wing terrorist attacks. You see, 1993 is missing. Here's some analysis we did, but I'm not going to show you that. This is when we looked at right-wing homicides in the U.S. It's actually hard to follow, but it's kind of interesting. And then, interestingly, I did hate crimes. And we have the FBI hate crime database, and so we can look more closely at that. I just did this kind of roughly. I took all of the... I got rid of hate crimes against white people, Protestants, and heterosexuals, and then I got rid of all... non-white offenders, and that's kind of the trend that you see. Again, it was a rough operationalization I literally did this in a morning, but I wanted to look at it, and the results are pretty robust how I measure right-wing extremism. So, yes.
Okay, very short. Really fascinating, I think a reason for living, for sure.
I do have more, but yeah.
It seems to me with the massive amount of data that you're actually going to have here that there is a possibility of really disaggregating. So this is by month. It would be super interesting from my point of view to go even further down and look at the really action patterns of this and the backlash what you were talking about, how that actually spells out. Have you gone that far yet?
Not yet. Sabbatical next spring. I mean, honestly, we really have just, by grouping it by conciliatory, repressive, discriminant, indiscriminate, that's still pretty rough. We have the actors. And like in the U.S., we have a lot of, you know, we do code a little bit more specifically, but there were some things that were said about using criminal justice actions versus military actions. That can be looked at. We can look at, it's pretty cool.
Very, very, very quick question. So does this account for things like budgets? So, for example, maybe your repression and non-repression things or wash out, but what really mattered was that there was a big investment in FBI in terms of resources and surveillance and a big increase in their budget, and maybe that's what caused the effect.
Right. So two comments for that. Anytime that there were budget discussions that have, like, increases in military spending and things like that, we did capture that when it showed up. However, we also are very aware that we could get external databases to integrate that into the model, so in order to look at that. And so that's something, if we wanted to look at the budgets and how budgets have changed, that's publicly available data that we could actually use to look at that.
Great. I think we're all looking forward to your research leave next year. And what comes of it, thanks very much, Laura.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.